Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. As you know, we Zoom the afternoon before, so if something should happen on Tuesday night, we will not be discussing it till Thursday. So as we've done every single day, and you've heard me say this, it's like part of the wallpaper of The Attitude. We begin every show with the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman during the impeachment hearings of 2019. I told people I wanted this powerful, patriotic voice in their heads when they exercised the franchise in November of 2020. I made the right decision. As you approach the election and you think about Ruth Bader Ginsburg and you think about Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, those are the voices that are in your ear as you decide how to vote in November. Now, Lieutenant Colonel Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
So I realized that I needed to reach out to Dave Schultz for a couple of reasons. One, because I wanted to talk to him about what's happening with the loss of RBG, what's happening with the Supreme Court, what can you do about what's happening with the Supreme Court, given the fact that Mitch McConnell is basically a handmaiden for Donald Trump, and actually Mitch McConnell has lived to change the bench, and he's been very effective at doing it. I also wanted to reach out to Dave Schultz, who's a Hamline University professor of political science. He also teaches at the University of Minnesota Law School. But I also wanted to talk to him because it appears that Minnesota may be a swing state. I'm looking at the money that Donald Trump is spending, and he's spending more money in Minnesota than he is in places like Wisconsin and Michigan. You have a U.S. senator who is up for re-election. And I thought, whoa, this is like a trifecta. So I better reach out to Dave. So let me welcome Professor Schultz of Hamline University to the program and thank him so much for joining us. And we have to start, Dave, because you sent me this little article about you and RBG, because you actually have a personal connection, not extensive, but a personal connection to her. Yes. And I want people to hear this little vignette because in a lot of ways, it actually says a lot about her because of what you were researching and both about her response.
It is. It's interesting. So this is a story that goes back a quarter of a century ago when she really has only been on the Supreme Court for just a few years. But at the time I was teaching at the University of Wisconsin, and one day a student, just by coincidence, it was a female student, raised her hand and said, how long does it take the Supreme Court to decide a case once oral arguments have occurred? And then she said, are there some justices that are faster than others at writing opinions? And I said, gosh, I really don't know. And all else fails, if you don't know, go do some research. So there happened to be a stretch there that I looked at 3 years in a row where I gathered up a list of all the Supreme Court cases, when they were oral arguments occurred, when they were decided, and who wrote the opinion. And what I discovered is that Ruth Bader Ginsburg hit the trifecta. For each of those 3 years, she was the fastest justice in terms of turning around opinions and overall the fastest. And by the way, just for coincidence here, the two fastest justices were Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Sandra Day O'Connor. The women waxed the guys.
I mean, I love it.
And in case you're also wondering, the slowest on the court was Clarence Thomas.
But he doesn't talk. So, you know,
he apparently doesn't write very quickly either. So anyhow, I wrote it up. Now, this was just a light piece, nothing too serious. I got it published at the University of Minnesota Law School where I teach. And this is all kind of like kitschy kind of stuff. So it was called Justice Delayed, Justice Denied, Fastest Justice in the East. I referred to Ruth Bader Ginsburg as Top Gun, you know, kind of like using like gunfighter, you know, like references like that.
Okay.
So I published it, and just as a courtesy, I mailed it to her, a small little letter just said, for your information if you want it. I never expected to hear back from her. And a couple of months later, I heard back from Ruth Bader Ginsburg with this delightful letter, in which, of course, she thanks me. But then, if I could actually pull this down here, I've got to actually read.
I love it.
The line is wonderful. She says, your article and accompanying letter made my day. As my children and now grandchildren will confirm, I am the slowest eater by far in the family. Nice to know my slowness at the dinner table is counterbalanced by my opinion production speed. A delightful. And then, by the way, the next paragraph that basically says, my other colleagues aren't slow. She was very gracious about explaining why they may take time. But first off, the fact that she wrote back to me, never expected that. Two, this humanness to her, and you got this sense of like sort of a self-deprecating sense of humor. I told my friends for years that I always had this image that, let's say, when her granddaughter was kind of saying something like, Grandma, you're so slow, pokey, or something like that, I always had an image of Ruth Bader Ginsburg saying to her, well, you know, there's a professor in Minnesota who says I'm the fastest justice around like that. So yeah. I read this, and it was a delightful letter. And also, it's hard to tell by looking at the picture, but it's her real signature, too. It wasn't an auto dial. And it's been sitting on my wall in my office for 21 years. This is from like the late 90s. And when she unfortunately passed away the other day, I looked up at it and I said, there's a story here to tell people, because we're all sharing like a story of what she meant to all of us.
Right.
And I wrote up in my blog, I talked about it, and people just loved it because it gave us a piece of a puzzle of her that we don't hear, but for so many of us, you know, I've been telling my students for the last couple of days, one of the most important things that she did, I think, in her entire career, not just as a great litigator, she was a phenomenal arguing before the court, but even on the court, is she brought a human real face to the law and a perspective to the law that's needed. Because we think of the law as being cold, impersonal, and uncaring. And that's what she did. And if I can just take another minute here.
Oh, no, please do.
To me, people are always going to talk about her most important cases and so forth. I don't know if it's her most important, but it's a case that always resonates with me. And it ought to be a case that should have made people mad to start with. And it was a case from the early 2000s. And it involved a teenage woman in high school. She was about 14 or 15 years old. And she's taking Advil for menstrual cramps. And the school had a policy against bringing any drugs in, calls her in, and it's a male principal, asks her to disrobe down to her bra and panties in his office, makes her kind of like open the cup of her bra, and I can't even describe it here on the air, like basically move her panties around in case there was any like Advil sitting in there. Her and her parents sue and saying, this is disgusting, you can't do this. At oral arguments, initially, the male justices laugh this all off and say, oh, no big deal. Who cares? I like that. It was kind of like locker roomish. And I can't remember what television show she went on. And she talked about this story and said, my colleagues don't understand what it's like to be a 14-year-old young woman. Don't understand what it's like to be, stripped down to your panties and bra, standing before an older principal. And she essentially shamed the court into voting the right direction eventually. Wow. And the reason why I like to tell the story, there may be many other cases that are more important. She brought a perspective, a sense of what, maybe you can help me with the word here, humanness to the law, and made the law think about the perspective of somebody else in ways that you don't see.
So when I first heard Shirley Chisholm speak, Shirley Chisholm encouraged this group of 400 poverty workers. Here we were advocating for our clients. And she said, you know what? You need to bring that knowledge into politics. You need to bring it into the House of Representatives. You need to bring it into the Senate. The reason is they don't get it. It's right. Not that they don't care. It's not that they don't get it. You have a lived experience that is so valuable. And especially, let's remember what you're talking about, a menstrual cycle. Taking Advil. If you've ever lived with the cramps sometimes at age 14, you think you're going to die. But the guys have never had menstrual cycles. They've never had the cramps. So on top of what the guy did by strip searching her, frankly, was not only to sort of harm her person.
That's right.
They didn't even understand, and either did the principal, why this was so important for her to be able to sort of function during the course of the day. She got it on every level. She got it on every level. And she not only shamed them, but she brought that understanding to the bench. And I think, again, that women aren't better than men, but they have a different lived experience than men.
Exactly.
And that's why they have to be there.
And what she did in the cases she litigated, in the cases she decided, I told my students today, she went from approach for where the law said that it was okay to treat women, or the phrase was sex, you know, that was the line in the law. It was okay to treat women as second class citizens and say the presumption was okay. So by the time she left the bench, categorizations or classifications based upon sex or gender are now presumptively unconstitutional. That is an enormous flip in the law. I told my students today, not taking away anything from her. At one point, someone said of her, she was the Thurgood Marshall of women. And what she actually did, she actually took that as a compliment. And she said, what Thurgood Marshall did on race, winning Brown and being on the Supreme Court, she took it as a compliment that she could do it. And I'm not taking away from what she's doing here, but that's how titanic of a figure she was. She did the same thing that Thurgood Marshall did. And people forget that.
The other thing that she did in terms of Thurgood Marshall is that with Ruth's passing, the two people who actually lived through the civil rights era and the women's rights revolution, legally and otherwise, these people were leading the charge on the front lines of these actual changes in our society as well as in our law, and they're now gone. So the people that are on there now are just reading about it in the history books.
But
Ruth and Thurgood, they were it.
Among thrills in my life, obviously getting this letter from Ruth Bader Ginsburg, of which now I look at in a very different perspective than I did back then. And just a quick side here, I had a teacher in law school who I never thought was very good until I realized in 2004, he was Thurgood Marshall's assistant in Brown. And suddenly it's like, oh my God, I don't care how crappy of a teacher he was at that point. It's like, he's history at this point. Okay, so now I got to tell one other story about this. So, in the blog, I talked about how this was in my office for years. This is now home. Okay, just to show you the weird world we live in now, just for the heck of this, I looked up online, a Ruth Bader Ginsburg signature now is $2,000. And I'm thinking, I am not leaving this in my office now. Because to me, it's not about the money. It's also about the fact, But somebody who would take it and sell it. But to me, it's like, how do you replace a letter like that?
You don't. And so let me just say one more thing. I've always wanted to sit down with Ruth Bader Ginsburg because of what she meant on the whole issue of equality. And I wanted to run something by her that I have been using in speeches when I talk about equality all the time. And I wondered how she would interpret it. And I always said that equality is not sameness. And what I mean by that is, I mean, look, when you think about Ruth was, I mean, attention to detail. She loved opera. She dressed gorgeously. I mean, she was incredibly feminine in how she sort of packaged herself. She never tried to be like the boys. She knew who she was.
That's right.
But what I meant was that equality is not sameness. I remember giving a speech and I said, here's what sameness is. 4 = 4. 2 = 2. 10 = 10. Here is equality. 5 + 5 = 10. 8 + 2 = 9 + 1. I said, they're equal, but they're not the same. Equal, but not the same. When people talk about equality, we sometimes get confused and think that we're asking to treat them the same. And what I'm saying is that it's not sameness, but there is something about equality, especially under the law, that says, you know, like she was saying when her dean of the law school said, how do you feel, you 9 women, by taking the seat away from 9 men at Harvard Law School? I mean, I'm surprised I didn't give him a knuckle sandwich, you know? Yeah. And I think to this day, she regretted what she said. I mean, she was so shocked at that she, you know, and she again sort of played the line of the spouse and the husband. But at the same time, that's what she lived. Can you imagine a dean saying that to a young, brilliant law student? Today, that dean would be fired. That
we
dean
hope.
Would be fired.
Well, we hope that dean would be fired. We know far too often in the world that we live in, unfortunately, schools and other places which still engage in behavior like that, what do? Quietly pay off or something like that. So I hope you're right on this. Yeah, I'll do another quick example. I know we want to get to other topics here. Now, it wasn't a case that she argued, but about the difference between equality and so forth like that, or equals, is that in the 1970s, there was a famous case where a woman challenged a decision by an insurance company not to pay for maternity leave and to pay for, not maternity, but to pay for maternal costs, you know, for giving birth to a child. She sued under the 64 Civil Rights Act. The Supreme Court, all guys at that point, said, well, there's no sex discrimination here. Why? They're not paying for maternity costs for men, and therefore, by not paying for maternity costs for women, there's no sex discrimination here.
Oh, my God.
Eventually, Congress did the right thing and said, no, you got it wrong, and passed the Pregnancy Discrimination Act. But that's the difference, because really, think about it, it's equal. We're not paying for maternity leave for men. We're not going to pay for women. That's equality. That's not equity.
Oh,
and so
God.
And it wasn't a case that she argued, but had she argued it, she probably would have beaten them. Yeah.
Oh my God. Amazing. All right. So let's get into what's happening. And I want to talk a little bit about the Supreme Court, because obviously now we know that as Mitch McConnell has suggested, he probably has enough votes
right. To
be able to confirm whomever Donald Trump puts forward.
Especially what's important about it is he has enough votes to do it sight unseen.
Yeah.
Isn't that more amazing? They haven't even gone through the charade of the confirmation process, and he's got the votes.
Right. I
mean, at this point, you know, my cat could probably get confirmed.
Well, but as I pointed out in something I posted on Facebook, this is not a Donald Trump appointment. This is a Federalist Society appointment.
Of course.
Federalist Society has basically made, I mean, he has outsourced it. And the Federalist Society has a portfolio of very young, anti-choice, conservative, pro-corporate, whatever, and they're ready to move them into the bench, and whether it's the Supreme Court or whether it's the rest of the federal bench. And it appears that at least one of the women that's on the short list has already been vetted. So, you know, I mean, not for the Supreme Court, but she has already been vetted for the federal bench.
Right.
So they're saying that, you know, this means it's not a heavy lift. We've already done this. This is no big deal. We're just moving her chair. You know, as if that's the case. And you and I both know that that's not the case, because now we have her opinions. We didn't have her opinions before. This is different. This is not just going from law school to the bench. This is going from the bench with a whole raft of opinions, where now you can begin to process sort of her thinking. And her thinking, frankly, right now, at least my understanding is that it is wicked conservative. You know, and for a lot of people who are worried about the cases that are coming forward, she is going to be doing exactly what people are concerned about with the Affordable Care Act. She's going to be doing exactly what people are concerned about Roe v. Wade, because now you have a legacy of decisions that you didn't have before. But it doesn't matter, does it, Dave? It doesn't matter.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't matter. Okay. So now the question is, where do we move forward on this? Okay.
Yes.
Practically nothing the Senate can do. Now, I know Nancy Pelosi said the other day she's got some weapons at her disposal. I don't know what those weapons are, short of like a budget issue, you know, like basically choking off budget. But this is too important to the Federalist Society and so forth. Okay, so I sketched out a scenario to my students today. I'm just going to play fantasy football here for a minute, okay? All right, so assume Biden gets elected and the Democrats pick up enough to at least get to 50 senators, if not to, let's say 51. But if they get to 50, Senator Harris,
right.
Vice President Harris gets to go to work at this point. So I said to students, remember 1937. 1937 is where Franklin Roosevelt threatened to pack the Supreme Court because they were ruling against him. He proposed extending the size of the Supreme Court and adding more players. He didn't eventually have to do it because he scared the bejeebers out of the Supreme Court at that point. Okay, so imagine a scenario where the Democrats now have the Senate, they have the presidency, Trump gets his nominee. Okay, can the Democrats increase the size of the Supreme Court? Yes and no. And I say no first because they would have to worry about the filibuster rule. But on the very first day when the Senate convenes, or on the, when Kamala Harris is sworn in, they could now say by a majority vote, they're going to change the filibuster rule, abolish the filibuster rule completely at that point, then push through legislation to expand the size of the Supreme Court. And then if they wanted to, they could pack the Supreme Court. Now, whether that's a viable option, I don't know, but that is something that the Republicans need to be thinking about.
So I heard something very interesting, and someone was saying, oh, this is a terrible thing because if they do it, then when the Republicans get control, they'll pack the court and the court will be like 9, then 12, then 15, then 20, then 50. And I heard a really interesting response by Ely Mostel from who writes for The Nation magazine. And he writes their law pieces. And he said, you know, maybe having 20 people on the court isn't such a terrible thing, or 22 or 21 or whatever. He said, because then the death of one will not be so catastrophic.
That's right.
And eventually he said, in a lot of ways, we're so terrified by that number, but now look what's happening. What's happening is because they are in perpetuity until they die,
right.
We are ending up with a lot of people who are there, who are in their 70s and 80s, and we're all living on the fear of when the next one's gonna go. And he said, if you have more people on the bench, so what? And as I mentioned to Ken, most of the decisions will never get to that bench.
Most
of the decisions are decided by the smaller Supreme Court, which is the Court of Appeals.
That's right.
We already know that Donald Trump has been very effective in packing the Court of Appeals. So, you know, everyone's waxing poetic about this when we already have sort of a fait accompli because he's been so effective at putting so many people on the bench.
Yeah. One of my female students this morning in class made a great comment, and she said, losing Ginsburg threatens my reproductive rights. And I said, we should probably live in a world where one person shouldn't be able to make that difference. And, and I'm making your point here.
Yes, the fact
that what you can, as I said to her, the fact that what you can do with your body hangs on the balance with one woman at this point who passed away on the Supreme Court is not a good sign for American democracy.
I totally agree.
Can I just say that your discussion about packing the court and, well, the Republicans will do it next and maybe it's not so bad to get up to 20 justices. I'm not going to argue with you about having a lot of justices, but the problem with that whole scenario is that we don't have any stability about who's going to control the court. So every time there's a new election, the party controlling the court changes. And of course, that means that the Supreme Court is certainly a very, very political body, more so than it is now. But the other thing that I wanted to ask Dave is, I read today that there is something that Schumer could do to make the Senate close business. And I guess that to go on with any business between now and the election, they need some kind of unanimous consent. Any one senator can block that. Could one of the Democratic senators do that and prevent any Senate activity, including confirmation, from going forward?
There are, again, I'm not an expert on all the rules of the Senate. I mean, some of these rules are incredibly arcane. There are some possibilities. Now, we know they can't filibuster this, but there may be other tools out there. And so much, you're correct, of what the Senate does is unanimous consent. That may be a possibility, but I wouldn't be surprised if that happens. Mitch McConnell finds some way of overruling on that. So I wouldn't hold out all that hope. But the thing I was going to say here is that the legitimacy of the court as an apolitical institution has been vastly damaged already at this point in the last few years. And that's one point. And so does my proposal or idea damage it even more? I don't know. But the second thing is when the Democrats say, well, if we do this, Republicans will do it. I said to my students this morning, the last Democrat that knew how to fight was Lyndon Johnson.
You're so right.
I mean, the Democrats have forgotten how to fight and fight. And I hate to say this here, fight to the death. I don't want to say fight dirty, but I'm going to. Johnson understood it. Carter was a wimp. Clinton was a wimp. Obama was a wimp. None of them knew how to scare the hell out of the Republicans. And at this point, what the Democrats need to do is scare the Republicans.
Well, and so you were talking about that there's no question that the court is incredibly political. And I posted something on Twitter, and I want to share this with you. I wrote, how could RBG and Scalia be such good friends? because in a way, I feel like it's the end of an era with those two.
Right.
Okay. That, you know, and I wrote, because both were principled human beings. When a person is guided by principles, it ensures trust despite disagreement, a lesson that has been lost on Mitch McConnell and his GOP senators. And that's the point. There's only power left. There's no principle left. There's no policy left. It is raw politics, as you describe. They keep saying, well, what about this principle? They never believed it anyway. They were just pulling something out of the air to give them what they claimed as the moment legitimate excuse to be able to do what they wanted to do. And what they wanted to do was available to them. Why? Because they had the power. Because they had the power. And the difference between Democrats and Republicans is that Republicans use their power and Democrats want the power. Well, you can't want it and not use it. And that's, I think, your point, David.
Okay. So the 30 seconds we have left. Yes, Minnesota is a potential swing state. The fact that Biden and Trump were here on the first day of our early voting, the fact they're both spending lots of money, and the fact is, for all intents and purposes, if the Democrats don't win Minnesota, they're probably going to lose the presidential election because these are 10 electoral votes that have been in their pocket. Minnesota is swing in part because why? It has a high percentage of white working class, non-college educated people parallel to Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin. And these are people who have all flipped to Trump. So we are potentially a swing state.
Well, I'm just going to say something. I remember talking to your Secretary of State the night before Jesse the Body and Mind Ventura won.
Yeah.
And I said to the Secretary of State, I said, I hate to break it to you, but I think Jesse's going to win. Oh, no way. Well, guess what? I think from the moment Jesse won that I began to realize this was potentially a purple swing state, and it's only become more and more so with each passing year. Dave,
exactly.
Schultz, I'm calling you back. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Talk to you soon. Bye. Okay.
All right, everyone, this is The Attitude with Audie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. We'll be right back.
We are a nation in a bad situation. So many folks are under attack. But we'll stay together, brave this bad weather. We've come too far now to turn.
We won't keep quiet.
Welcome back to part two of the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. So we have to talk foreign policy. We haven't talked about it for a long time. There are so many things that seem to get in our way. But in a funny way, the pandemic is a story of foreign policy. It really is, because it's worldwide and it's impacting us on so many levels, and not just from a health perspective. And so whenever I think foreign policy, what do? I reach out and I grab Mel Goodman. Mel Goodman is a former CIA analyst. He is now currently teaching at Johns Hopkins. He is a prolific writer, has written many, many books. But when it comes to issues of the Middle East, when it comes to issues of Putin, when it comes to issues of trying to understand who is Donald Trump and what is he doing on the world stage and what is he trying to dismantle? And frankly, I don't think he's trying to dismantle anything, but he claims that he is. Mel, I called you not realizing that today was the opening of the UN, and that sure enough, who would be speaking on Tuesday, because we Zoom on Tuesday for Wednesday, but Donald Trump. And they said that they think that he gave the shortest speech at the UN ever in UN history, 7 minutes. And I thought that was 6 minutes too long myself. So a little bit about your thoughts about him, because my understanding is that Donald Trump does what he does really well. He blames everyone else.
Well, he spoke for 7 minutes because when he spoke longer a few years ago, they were laughing at him. So to avoid any possibility that he would be humiliated in that way, he kept it as short as possible. He has nothing to offer. He has nothing to say. One of the impacts, I think, of the pandemic that I worry about is the world is going inward. The world is turning in on itself. Nations are becoming more nationalistic. They're becoming less global-minded. Trump, with his American First policy, has led the way. So he's out there taking credit for things that aren't even true, let alone whether anyone can take credit for them, like the annihilation of the Islamic State, for example. Well, there are probably 18,000 fighters still left in Iraq and Syria, and the ISIS fighters in Iraq are giving the Qaddimi government a pretty rough time. So wherever you look, he has worsened all of our relations, starting with the transatlantic relationship, starting with NATO. This decoupling of relations with China is very dangerous. It may sound effective on a short-term basis, the way it's explained by Peter Navarro and Robert Lighthizer and Matt Pottinger on the National Security Council, but the long-term implications of a decoupling with China are, I think, horrendous, because the United States and China represent the key bilateral relationship in the world. The key issue is climate. If you're going to get a solution to the climate problem or any way to address it, it's got to be a club led by the United States and China, the two biggest polluters in the world to begin with. So climate could serve the purpose that arms control did with the Soviet Union. The key to detente with the Soviet Union was arms control policy. The key to an effective relationship with China will be the climate problem. And when you look at what's happening in our far west, what's happening on the Gulf of Mexico, on the coast, we're dealing with the consequences of climate. And if you look at Pentagon statements about national security policy, they recognize climate as the number one national security issue. They're not falling for the malarkey about the Islamic State and various insurgencies. Climate is a national security problem. So this is the denial that Trump has been, the science denial, the intelligence.
Well, exactly. And yet what I thought was also interesting was that the Secretary General of the UN, what did he talk about? But he talked about the vaccine wars. He's really, I mean, he's looking at the pandemic in a lot of ways like we're looking at climate change. We've got to do this together.
Globally.
We have to do it globally.
Independently.
Exactly.
So when we pull out of the World Health Organization, what is China do the next day? Gave a ton of money to the World Health Organization. China has already co-opted countries in Africa and South Asia. They're offering free vaccines when they're available to places like Indonesia and Bangladesh. And they're offering very low-cost loans to countries in Africa and South America that are going to need help in fighting this pandemic, because the public health systems in the third world are horrendous. Of course, the great tragedy, you have a rich country like the United States with a public health system that's not only been underfinanced, but it's been politicized. Look what the Health and Human Services Department is doing to the CDC. You can't have any faith, any trust. Again, you're not going to solve a pandemic crisis without the trust of the people. If Trump offers a vaccine, would you take it? I know I wouldn't.
what is so interesting to me is not only to see what he's done with science, not only to see, as they said at Slate magazine, he flipped the bird at the world and he blamed China and he blamed the WHO and, you know, everything he claimed that he had done so successfully, it was so easy to shred. But this is the more remarkable thing is when I read what Chinese President Xi Jinping said at the UN. And I posted this, you're gonna love, I think I showed it to you, Mel. I posted who said this, okay? And I quoted Xi. And what he said was, we need to increase confidence and trust. Let us join hands. Together we can make the world a better place for everyone. And he goes on and on and on. And I'm reading this and I'm going, he sounded like Barack Obama, okay? And I posted it and I said, so who said this? Trudeau, you know, I went through this whole list, Boris Johnson, and I mentioned Xi as one of the possibilities. And people, when they actually Googled it and realized who said it, I mean, this is how upside down it is, Mel. I don't believe Xi either, to be honest with you.
No, you can't believe anything Xi said.
Exactly.
But the fact is, he's saying all the right things and getting credit for something he doesn't deserve while he's knocking heads in Xinjiang among the Uyghur population and what he's doing to Hong Kong and aggressive moves in the South China Sea. But people aren't paying any attention to that because Xi Jinping is an internationalist. He's a globalist. Yes. It's a mercantile state that has to have good economic relations, state-to-state economic relations around the world, and they do.
I spoke to my daughter this morning, and she's very upset about the educational system in the United States. And she said, Mom, let me just tell you something. I went to a very poor school outside of Shanghai, a poor elementary school. The fourth graders were coding in their fourth grade class.
Sure.
I mean, with these rickety old computers, but they were learning to code. She said, I cannot tell you how much more advanced educationally China has now made it possible for their kids. And then you go here. She said, not only is your healthcare system been shredded, not only have you suffered the worst consequences from the pandemic, but let me tell you about school. She said, you have no idea that we have eroded the quality of our educational system. How long can we last on the past?
We do something that no other country in the world does, and that is we finance education with property taxes. So where you have expensive homes and high property taxes and high taxes generally, you have good schools. If you have the opposite, you have poor schools. So this is part of the structure of this country where inequality is created two societies. There are two Americas.
Yeah.
It's not just that there's a red America and a blue America. There's a rich, very rich and wealthy America, and then a very poor America. And that has health consequences, it has education consequences, it has infrastructure consequences. When you look at the environmental situations, who has the greatest effects of the environmental problem? It's poor communities that are located near power plants or polluted waters or factories that are belching all sorts of pollutants. This needs to be addressed.
And this, let me just share a story because we're doing stories today. So I remember fighting an incinerator, and the incinerator had been basically denied access to Massachusetts. So because they couldn't build in Massachusetts, it was a moratorium, they decided to move up to New Hampshire because this is live free or die, right? They originally went to Exeter. You know where Phillips Exeter is? Well, that wasn't going to happen because the rich Phillips Exeter people said, no way, Jose, are we getting an incinerator? So what did they do? They targeted the poor town of Epping. And they went into Epping and they offered them a payment in lieu of taxes and they offered them fire departments and whatever. In order, why? Because they knew they could buy the community because the community was desperate for cash. Why? Because property taxes funded education and they didn't have a property tax base. So what do they get? They would have gotten the trifecta of a dirty incinerator that would have really polluted their air, harmed our state in order to what? In order to pay the bills so they could have a damn school. Exact. And this is 1988, Mel. It's only gotten worse, Mel.
Sure.
You know, we stopped the incinerator, but Epping hated me for a decade. You know, it's not that they wanted the damn incinerator. They wanted the cash.
Well, this is the great flaw of our system of capitalism. It needs reform. It needs to be addressed. And no one's taking that on. There's so many issues that need reform, that need debate, that need change. And we're not going to see it. You know, Biden's going to have to pick two or three things to address. But there's so much that needs to be rehabilitated.
So you wrote an article about the Marines. And I wasn't going to, like, I mean, I saw the article. I'm like, oh, I don't care. And then I read the article and I went, oh, I do care. So tell my audience the story of the Marines, why you wrote it, and really the dirty little secret that nobody knows about them. Again, there's so many things in view, but we don't really understand what we're looking at.
Well, the Marines are as old as the country itself, and they have a wonderful history. They have many incredible exploits, from World War II, the island hopping campaign, World War I, Belleau Wood, where so many were lost. And they had an incredible amphibious invasion in the Korean War, in the first few months of the Korean War, Incheon. Incheon was 70 years ago. That's the last time the Marines have ever conducted an amphibious invasion. Meanwhile, they've built a service of 185,000 servicemen, men and women, that's larger than the British military, exercises amphibious exploits, but never conducts them because, one, they're much too dangerous to conduct. But every time the Pentagon wants a new weapon system, they have to provide a variant for the Marines. So if they build the F-35 jet fighter, they have to build an F-35 jet fighter that has vertical takeoff and landing capability to accompany an amphibious launch that they're never going to make. If they build an Osprey helicopter, they have to make a vertical takeoff and landing capability. You're talking about adding tens and hundreds of billions of dollars to a defense budget that already is bigger than the entire world spends on defense. That's another secret that no one seems to know about. When you take in all of American military spending, and so it's not only the Pentagon, it's the Department of Energy, it's the $70 billion intelligence community budget that mainly serves the military, it's the Homeland Security, those parts of the budget that serve the military, the Veterans Administration, we spend over $1 trillion for defense. When's the last time we won a war? Korea was a stalemate, Vietnam was a loss, Iraq was a loss, Afghanistan was a loss. But we keep pouring money into exploits we shouldn't be entering or to weapon systems we're never going to use. We're still manufacturing tanks. Now, give the military credit. They would like to stop the construction of tanks, but Congress won't let them because when the Congress looks at the defense bill, they see jobs. It's a jobs bill. The biggest jobs bill we have is the
jobs bill is making things we don't need and we don't use. The jobs bill you want is the jobs bill for alternative energy. The jobs bill you want is an infrastructure jobs bill. I mean, what is so amazing to me is how come, Mel, we can't get these guys to pivot? If the military doesn't want these half tracks or these whatever, why can't we create another alternative where we're saying you want jobs? Put the money here, get jobs that we can actually use that ultimately really make us safe.
Well, they've been bought, basically. Look at California. I remember when you had two very liberal senators from California, Barbara Boxer and Dianne Feinstein were in at the same time. Very liberal on foreign policy issues. But when it came to defense, Lockheed Martin makes most of serious stuff right there in California. They're not going to take on Lockheed Martin. Joe Lieberman would never take on the Navy in Connecticut. So you have these powerful senators who are protecting their equities, and you have important weapon systems like the F-35, which gave John McCain sticker shock. That's built, when you think of all the parts that go into an F-35, of the 50 states, I think 46 states build something that contributes to the manufacturing of the F-35. That's brilliant marketing on the part of Lockheed Martin. Now you look at the Secretary of Defense. Who's the Secretary of Defense? Mark Esper. What was Mark Esper? He was Vice President of Raytheon for Government Relations. So Raytheon's going to get what? So you look at these so-called peace, they're calling peace deals, Bahrain and Israel, United Arab Emirates and Israel. They're not peace deals, they're business deals. They're selling weapons to these countries. And now Israel's arguing, well, you can sell weapons, but not the very sophisticated weapons. We don't want any F-35s. Now, what is not widely known is in 2008, Obama agreed in an Israeli military assistance. They don't even buy stuff. We just give it to Israel more than we give to any other country in the world. And Israel has an economy where they can pay for their own weapons themselves. But that's another story. But they have something in the defense arrangement with Israel called the qualitative military edge. Israel maintains it must have a qualitative military edge. So to sell certain systems to the Middle East, like the F-35 to UAE, Israel has to agree. When Egypt wanted the F-35, Israel said no. And what about the F-16? Egypt said, okay, but you can't base it near Israeli border. So they determined where the F-16 should be based. Israel had this kind of leverage over U.S. military arrangements. And we are the world's arms merchant. If you go back over the last 20 years, we sell more arms to the entire world than all countries combined. and we sell them recklessly. And then when you look at military aid, where does military aid go? And we're supposed to get some leverage for it. Well, it goes to places like Egypt. We don't have any leverage there. Pakistan, they're not even an ally. Turkey, look what Turkey has done to us in the last few years. They bought the S-400 air defense system that targets the F-35. They're supposed to be a member of NATO. They're supposed to be an ally.
But so how do we radically change? Will climate change and the cost of climate change, will the pandemic and the cost of the pandemic, will the tanking of the economy suddenly make us realize that we have been pouring trillions of dollars into this swamp, and that's what it is, the Pentagon swamp, that we're not getting safety, we're not getting security, we're building things we don't need. We are basically, as you said, arming the world so that they can eventually use it against us anyway. And I'm looking at this, and at what point do you say, this is a mistake and it doesn't make us safe?
Well, if it's going to happen in the current time frame, then it should be discussed right now during a presidential campaign. Is it being discussed? Of course not. And the problem that you have, and my next book is going to the publisher next week, is called Containing the National Security State. We are a national security state. We're an economy that revolves around the weapons programs, around militarization. The military has become more important than the civilian officials in the national security arena. The Department of State really doesn't exist in terms of policy conceptualization. There's no such thing as policy planning. You have the worst Secretary of State in the history of the Department of State, and you have a military that operates very well. It's very effective. It markets itself well. It does good PR. It has very high standing when public opinion polls are taken of various institutions of government. The military gets the highest marks in terms of trust and credibility. So until you start to change this culture, which is not easy to do in the first place, so we're spending ourselves into the ground while China has enhanced its economy very well with a Belt and Road Initiative. That's like it's a new Silk Road that's taking it into Europe, into South America, into Africa. We go into Africa with military troops. We go in there with special forces. China goes in there and builds infrastructure and takes out resources, takes the resources back to China, builds items with great manufacturing plants. They are the world's factory. We are the world's consumer.
But again, what I think is just so shocking is that because we are now living in this financial edge where the richest country in the world can immediately become, I think, one of the poorest countries in the world, despite what you're describing, because of the impacts. I mean, we started the conversation. We've got fires in California and Oregon and Washington. We've got floods in Houston and Louisiana, whatever. Yeah. We're going underwater in Miami. I mean, we're just looking at that. And then we're realizing that we're writing unlimited checks with lots of commas in them because of this pandemic, not even sure that we're going to get a result that we can actually use.
Throw in the pandemic. South Korea and the United States had the first fatality due to COVID-19 on the same day. It was January the 20th or January the 21st. Right now, we have had over 200,000 deaths. South Korea is running around 350 deaths in the same time period. And Taiwan, which has a lot of communication with China back and forth logistically in terms of commerce, 20 deaths in Taiwan from COVID-19. Now, of course, they were lucky. The vice president of Taiwan, when this pandemic broke out, happened to be an epidemiologist. Germany has done very well because Angela Merkel is a scientist. Exactly. We don't allow room for science in the White House. It took 2 years of pressure to get Trump to even appoint a science advisor. No one knows his name. He has no skill set whatsoever to deal with this pandemic, and he's bringing people in to deal with the pandemic who are not epidemiologists or immunologists. We don't have a federal policy. We're back to the Articles of the Confederation in terms of how we're dealing with this.
I said exactly that the other day. We're back to the Articles of Confederation. There is no support from the feds. You're on your own, Jack. You're going to have to figure it out. I use the example, for example, in New England, we have something called REGI, the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, where a group of New England states got together. They said, okay, we want to deal with climate change. We can't wait for the federal government. We're going to find our own way of beginning to address it. We're going to see more and more of that happening because basically the federal government has abandoned us, and yet we are responsible for people. We still have to take care of people. And if it's not going to come to the federal government, then we're going to have to figure it out ourselves. And you're right. It's the Articles of Confederation all over again. Ken, you wanted to weigh in.
Yeah, thanks. Mel, you were talking earlier about changes that we were going to have to make to our capitalist economy. And I'm curious what changes they are, and in particular, how that would help to reverse what you've been talking about with our military equipment. You know, our economy thrives on selling these outrageous, expensive, and useless military products to the rest of the world instead of employing, having a jobs program that employs people to produce renewable energy or infrastructure in the U.S. or other things that could be useful products. And that's, I assume, because of the something about the way our capitalist economy is working. Those companies have the big power. The renewable energy companies don't. But what kinds of changes could be made that would make some of these problems dissipate?
Well, you start with going back to the morning Dwight Eisenhower gave in 1961 when he was on his way out about the military-industrial congressional complex. You know, he wrote in congressional in that speech, but then when he gave the speech, he dropped the word. So you've got to break into that combine, which is really fed this military beast with its bloated budget and its operational tempo all over the world, 800 bases and facilities all over the world. So this has to be broken down to a certain degree.
Oh.
Use the military to defend the United States. We use the military to defend our foreign policy. No other country uses its military in that fashion. And then we're going to have to realize we're going to have to pay more taxes in this country. We don't pay enough into the Treasury to do the things we need to do in terms of infrastructure, in terms of educational reform, in terms of public health. So when you look at the terrible inequality, social inequality and economic inequality, you're going to have to address that. And the tax structure won't allow for addressing it because it's so unbalanced.
You know what? I agree with you. I'm a tax reform queen here. But my problem is I don't want my taxes to be addressed until you start dealing with the Pentagon budget.
No, I listed that. That's why I mentioned that first.
Right. And that, I think, is the big problem here. And part of the problem with the Pentagon budget is you've got, you know, money in politics. They're bought. You don't have term limits, so they've been living on the Pentagon teat, and I mean members of Congress, forever. Because again, you know, they want to bring back the bacon, and the bacon they're always bringing back is something that Raytheon wants. It's something that Lockheed Sanders wants. I mean, that's what the bacon is. They're not bringing things that people need. They're not bringing things that people could use that will save their lives. They're bringing back pieces of equipment that basically we don't even, not only do we not need, but we're selling to someone who will eventually use it on us. I mean, it is just so shocking. How do we get people to understand this is not about safety?
Well, remind people what they were told. When we developed nuclear weapons, they said it would be a cost savings because we could put less into conventional weapons. Well, that was a lie. Yeah. Now you have a nuclear triad. You have the intercontinental ballistic missile, you have the sea-based intercontinental missile, and you have strategic air power. You don't need all three. You don't need a triad. Now, during the debate of 2016, you had Donald Trump didn't even know what the triad was. He didn't know what the question was all about when there was a reference to the triad. You should do away with intercontinental ballistic missiles. They're just stationary targets. That's the first thing that could be taken out. But when you talk about nuclear weapons, they have no utility anyway, unless you want to blow up all of us. You can't fight on a nuclear battlefield. But then we're talking about nuclear modernization. We're going to put $1 trillion into nuclear modernization.
Well, but Donald Trump says that he's got some nuclear weapons you don't even know about. I mean, what is that about, Mel? Where did that come from? Is that real? See, what scares me about him is people do tell him stuff. They may tell him on the
Q. But remember, when Rex Tillerson called him an effing moron, it was because of his remarks about nuclear power and nuclear weapons and increasing our nuclear inventory tenfold is what Donald Trump wanted to do. And he based his remarks on what Steve Bannon said. The more nuclear powers we have in the country, the safer we'll all be because everyone will have a deterrent power. That's an argument for incredible waste. And eventually there's going to be that accidental problem, that catalytic situation that's going to put us all at risk. We've been very lucky so far.
And so you know what, Mel? This is the problem. The problem is that's the only time we address anything. It has to be, it's not just, Donald Trump is the chaos president. He's really smart. Because the only time we actually focus on something is when there's a destruction. It's when there's all the fires that we're seeing now in California. We have to live the failure, even though everyone's been telling us the failure is coming. They can even pinpoint why it's coming, but they will not believe it until it happens. And that is what's so tragic. That is the that's the tragedy of our democracy.
And remember what Pogo said, we've met the enemy and he is us.
And on that note, you are not the enemy. You are Mel Goodman. You teach at Johns Hopkins. You are a former CIA analyst. We absolutely adore Mel Goodman. And you'll have to call us when the book comes out. Thank you for joining us.
Stay safe.
I will, I promise. This is Bye-bye. The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and Ken Barnes. We'll schmooze tomorrow. Ciao.
Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try. Sky. Imagine all the people living for today. Imagine there's no countries. It isn't hard. The world.